comparison between the DNA on the bomb and the DNA on a criminal database. That would be one simple way, straightforward way of doing it. There are others, but that's an example for you.
Well, that's an amazing example and a story that continues after 20 years. We're out of time here, but I want to let people know we've been speaking with Daryl Cherney. His attorneys, people who represent Daryl and Judy Berry, are going to be in court trying to prevent the FBI from destroying evidence and maybe finally turn around a 20-year-plus attempt by federal, state, local law enforcement to shut down this investigation into who tried and came close to killing Judy Berry and changed history and almost cost Daryl Cherney his life as well. Daryl, we wish you the best of luck. 30 seconds, if people want more information, what do you suggest?
If they want to contact me, they can go to dc@asis.com. That's dc@asis.com, or my website, darylcherney.com. They can contact me that way.
Daryl Cherney, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to that documentary about all of this.
Yes. We'll be completing our first draft this mid-September. We're just a couple weeks away from our first draft completion.
Looking forward to that. All right, Daryl Cherney, thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
So good to hear Nora's voice on the air. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and can be heard again at flashpoints.net. Executive producer of Flashpoints is Dennis Bernstein. Technical director is Eric Klein. Roving producers, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Special projects and online producer, Jesse Strauss. Regular contributors to this program include Catherine Austin Fitz for Community Business, John Gibler in Mexico, Kevin Pina on Haiti, and Friday co-hosts Francisco Herrera and Rene Saucedo. JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archived shows, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/flashpointsnews. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is now 11 o'clock straight up. That means it's time for the Dirt Bag. And I'd like to remind everyone to tune in tonight at 7 o'clock for the second of two candidate forums for the KBOO Board of Directors election. We'd like you to hear statements, questions, and answers from the candidates.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor for the 7th annual Vancouver Peace and Justice Fair. The Vancouver Peace and Justice Fair is a full-day celebration surrounding the work of peace, environment, and social justice organizations in the Greater Clark County area. Over 50 organizations and businesses will be present for networking, signing up volunteers, educating, and disseminating information. Next to the playground, there will be children's activities including face painting, art, and creative expression. There will be live music from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., including a drum circle and the Tom Grant Band. The fair is located at Esther Short Park at 8th and Columbia in Vancouver, Washington, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the event is free and open to the public on September 11th. More info, kboo.fm/Vancouver Peace. KBOO is a proud media sponsor of the Belmont Street Fair. The Street Fair will be on Sunday, September 12th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. between Southeast 34th and 37th Avenues on Southeast Belmont. The street will be closed to traffic, but there will be over 150 craft booths, four musical performance areas, a food festival, and a children's fun center. There will also be two free shuttles, a bluegrass trolley, and a Mexican Fiesta bus that will be traveling between Southeast 20th and Southeast 58 along Belmont. For more info, kboo.fm/Belmont Street Fair.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Squirrel Farm, reconfiguring residential and commercial environments with life in mind. For information and a consultation, the number is 971-645-5232 or squirrelfarm.org. Also by One Green World, a nursery located near Molalla, Oregon, offering hard-to-find plants designed to help you grow your own fruit and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. For a color catalog, the number is 503-651-3005, and the website is www.onegreenworld.com.
Well, good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock. It's time for the Dirt Bag. Welcome. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 o'clock with me, as usual, Jim Gilbert. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Glenn. Hi, everybody.
It's been 2 months since we've been, 3 months, really, I guess, since we've been on live. No.
Yeah.
We did it in July.
Taped one in August.
Yeah. Okay. So here we are, just 2 months later. Here he is. But not only is Jim here, but two special guests so far, and we'll have two more later on that. The most special would have to be Jim's daughter. Emmy is here. Welcome, Emmy.
Hi, everyone.
Emmy has been tracking the spotted wing Drosophila, and she'll give us an update on that. And also sitting quietly in the studio is Taggart Siegel, the director of the brand new, soon to be world debuted here in Hollywood. Well, the Hollywood Theater.
In Hollywood, too.
Yeah. Was it going to be on the same day? Oh, he's mic-less. Speechless, yes. Queen of the Sun. And we'll be talking about that for a good half hour, along with the producer of the film and one of the participants in the film, who's a local beekeeper. So we're going to talk bees and the plight of the humble honeybee at the second hour. But first of all, Jim, what's going on in the gardening world? Some events that you'll be at and other things?
Well, as you might have noticed, it rained. And
yes.
I was in Portland last night and barely made my way out. It was so, I couldn't even see. It was so much coming down. And
record
so,
rain
yeah,
for that
well,
date.
Was it really?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, I can believe it. So what does that mean? That means that we can start planting. Fall planting time is here, and just in time, there are a couple of garden shows coming up, plant sales, the Hardy Plant Society, two different chapters, but basically, I guess, one chapter and then the state organization. In Salem this coming Saturday, the Hardy Plant Society of Salem, actually it's not in Salem, it's in Rickreall.
Mm.
I'm sure everybody knows where Rickreall is. It's the home of the Polk County Fairgrounds.
Uh-huh.
So if you're wanting to go out to the country and have some fun and get some plants, head on down to Rickreall.
This is all types of plants, not just ornamentals, but some edibles.
Edibles, ornamentals, probably everything under the sun.
Indeed.
30-plus vendors, as I understand. And if you can't make it to Rickreall, then the following weekend, the 18th and 19th, at the Expo Center in Portland, the Hardy Plant Society of Oregon is having its fall sale. And that will also have a lot of vendors and a lot of plants. So, and you can take Max out to the Expo Center and just load up with plants. Get going. Start planting. And just in case people wonder about, planting in the fall is a really good idea because the plants get a chance to get their roots established. They sort of get in place. And when spring comes, they can really take off and be very happy.
Excellent. You've also got some things going, some fruit tastings at the One Green World World Headquarters, huh?
That's right. We're gathering fruit today.
This Saturday, the second Saturday, which you do, is this 12 months a year or how many months a year?
Every second Saturday of the month we invite people.
I mean, of the year?
Every 12 months a year.
12 months, okay. Yeah. Come out to see what's blooming, what's producing.
Right, what's to eat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Well, that's fun.
That happens this Saturday, 10 to 4:30. And then the first three Saturdays in October, you have the Harvest Festival.
That's right.
Where you can sample all sorts of things that are grown there on your farm.
Ice cream, juice, all made with fruit.
Unusual fruits.
Unusual fruits.
Right, okay.
So sea berry, honey berry.
More information on the on all of those things, onegreenworld.com.
Yes.
That's out Molalla way.
Yes, yeah, out in the country.
Another nice drive out that way.
It is. It's a very nice drive, very peaceful.
Highway 213 is used to be one of my favorite bicycling routes, but it's a little more crowded now.
Yeah, and there's a place on Highway 213 where there's no shoulder, and it's that's a little bit of a challenge. You get south of where we are, there's some pretty deep ditches.
Yeah, thrill seekers.
Yeah.
Wear your helmet.
That's right.
Okay, anything else to coming up?
Well, I just want to mention also that we've got a couple of interesting visitors right now with us from Ukraine, Sergei and Natasha. And today, Natasha is making some really wonderful Carnelian cherry jam to taste at our harvest festivals and also at the second Saturday. Plus, Sergei is a walnut breeder, and he's showed us how to special methods of grafting walnuts, which we hope will allow us to start offering more walnuts to folks and bring that one nut back to Oregon.
Boy, I'd hate to have to plant one in my yard because those squirrels... I'm going to have to take drastic measures here one of these days.
Yeah. I think there's a population explosion. We were talking about that the other day. Whatever the things have come together, the stars have aligned, and they've got lots to eat, and they're breeding babies all the time. So.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So in the vegetable world, boy, harvesting. Time to harvest things. Despite our rain here, it's been not a bad year. The tomatoes now are, the big ones are even starting to ripen up nicely. Corn's on and eggplant coming on, even though our development director, Andrew, said he yanked his eggplants out.
Really?
Yeah, he thought, no, he's just not going to be happy. So he was going to plant more greens.
Huh.
No, we still got another month and a half of good producing, and who knows what the weather's going to be.
That's right. Right. We hope we deserve a long, warm fall after that long, cold, and wet spring.
Next month, we'll be talking some about cover crop planting. It's not too late, or it's not too early to do that now. A good time after this rain and everything to do that. But let's turn to Emmy, and she can tell us what she's been doing this summer. You've been tracking has it been elusive?
Well, it was a little bit elusive at first in the early part of the spring, but we got to see a lot of it by the end of the summer.
Describe what this pest is and why it's different than other fruit flies.
Well, it is a vinegar fly, but the reason that it's so such a bad pest here is that it lays its eggs in fruit that is not ripe or it is not overripe, so it can ruin crops before they've even... gotten to the ripe stage.
How is this different than other, fruit fly pests that Oregon already sees?
Well, the typical fruit fly lays its eggs in fruit that's already fallen on the ground, so it's not really something that is of economic threat to growers. This fruit fly lays its eggs in the fruit as it's on the bush, so before harvest, it can ruin the crop. So basically, it will lay its egg in the fruit. The fruit will start to rot on the bush, like blueberries, raspberries, etc. And then as they pick them, the fruit will be soft and has little worms in it. So,
yeah, we can call them maggots.
Yeah, maggots. I don't like to call them maggots, but that's what they are.
You're right. So you said blueberries, raspberries, etc. What are some of these et ceteras here?
Well, we found them in strawberries. They were a lot of them in raspberries. They're in blackberries. Basically, they'll lay their eggs in any soft fruit, and they have been found to go into peaches as well. And they don't prefer grapes, but in the lab, they've gotten them to lay their eggs in grapes. So.
Hmm. tell me about what you were doing this summer.
Well, basically, I was monitoring the progression of this fruit fly since it's a very new pest to Oregon.
How new?
Let's see, they found it at the end of the summer last year. So this is really the first full summer that it's been a problem here in Oregon. It was in California for a few years prior to that. So we're just trying to see how it works here in Oregon with our sort of growing season and everything. But basically, I was setting traps, which were vinegar cups, out in the field, and then we would check them weekly and count the number of flies in each trap. So there was a lot of dead fly counting that happened.
And this was in all of the Willamette Valley?
Yeah, we did stuff from the southern Willamette Valley all the way up. I was mostly in southwest Washington. And then we went up into more of Washington, and there's people studying it up in northern Washington, and it's been found in Canada as well. So it's moved pretty quickly up the West Coast.
You were employed by a company that got a grant from who? I've forgotten that now.
We got grants from the small berry commissions in Southwest Washington, and then we also had grants from state of Oregon. So we were able to study all fruit crops in Oregon. In Washington, we only did strawberries and raspberries and blackberries. So
now this pest is called the spotted wing Drosophila.
Yeah, that's correct.
Can one see the spotted wings?
Yeah, actually, I did a lot of staring at the spotted wings daily. So basically, the male has a relatively large spot on the wing. And that's the best way you can find them out of, from the other fruit flies. The females were a little bit more tricky to identify. You had to look on their lower abdomen for an ovipositor. Which other fruit flies don't really have such a thing that sticks out. So it was sort of looking through a magnifying glass.
I see.
And staring at dead flies.
Well, so can you see them with the naked eye?
You could see the males with the naked eye. Yes. Uh-huh. And the females, I got to the point where I could tell which ones were the females from the other fruit flies. But it took some training to figure that out. So.
You attracted other flies besides the Drosophila,
yeah,
the spotted wing Drosophila.
Uh-huh. There's other types of vinegar flies that would also go in the traps, but they're the kind that lay their eggs in the overripe fruit. So,
yeah. Is that the kind of fruit fly that we are most familiar with? It might be on our counter with peaches,
yeah.
Or
yes, yeah, that would be the fly that you would see in your kitchen, around your compost or.
They're kind of they have a little rusty reddish tinge to them, even, do they not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean the fly itself, they look very similar. The main thing that differentiates them is the spot on the wing. So if you looked on your counter and you saw one with two spots on the tips of their wings, uh-huh. That would be the spotted wing Drosophila.
Oh boy.
Well, Emmy was actually trapping out at our place. Or not, Emmy wasn't doing it, but one of the people from the company they set traps around our nursery. Because we had a lot of fruit.
Yeah, and?
And as far as I understand, there was very little found. I mean, one area where we had fruit that had already fallen, they found them. But I had never, and all the fruit I picked this year, I never found one that had anything in it.
Were you picking soft fruit? You made that comment, that stuck with me. So, it's apples, pears, is that not considered a soft fruit?
Yeah, they have not been found to go into apples or pears, so those are safe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll take a first musical break, and then we'll come back and see what is being done to combat that. This is about as close as I could come to a appropriate piece of the music for the topic at hand here. We'll be back in a bit.
Solid forming in the air, and the wall of death is lowered in Times Square. No one seems to care, they carry on as if nothing was there. The wind is blowing harder now, blowing dust into my eyes. The dust settles on my skin, making a crust I cannot move in. And I'm hovering like a fly, waiting for the windshield on the freeway.
That is some old, old Genesis, yes. The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. That is called Fly on a Windshield. All right, that's as close as I can come to this one.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Okay, so the spotted wing Drosophila is the topic at hand now with Emily. And what's your last name now?
Paget.
Paget, yes. The newly wedded Emily.
Emmy, excuse me.
Got to get that straight here. Formerly known as Emmy Gilbert. That's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So she is, now we're going to move into, well, what is being done and what do we think might be going, what's going to happen? What's the progression that we expect?
Well, basically, this being our first year, we're sort of trying to figure out our plan of attack. You know, it's been in California for a few years, so they've gotten a method down for controlling it. Here in Oregon, we don't know how many life cycles it will go through. So, pesticides are with sort of, you know, when do you spray, what do you spray? Basically, what we found is that controlling the population as best as you could before the fruit was infested is the best way to keep them from really growing in population. So a lot of farmers were spraying insecticides on a regular basis, probably on a 10-day, you know.
To try to prevent it.
Yes. Yeah. So that'll lower the population of the breeding adults, and then you won't have the fruit getting infested. Because once it's in the fruit, the mm-hmm. insecticides aren't going to do mm-hmm. anything. So,
what percentage of fruit would you guess has been infected?
Well, it earlier in the season, strawberries, it was very, very minimal. Raspberries, as the season progressed, the fruit on the ground was fully infested, I would say, in most growers' fields in Southwest Washington anyway. In Oregon, it wasn't quite as bad, but the raspberries definitely had a lot. And then they were moving into blackberries. So basically, we would do a baggie test where we would pick the fruit and put it in a bag and look to see if the maggots crawled out of the fruit. And
you can't really tell that it's been an egg has been laid in it?
In the raspberries and blackberries, it's harder. In blueberries, you can see actually a little pinprick hole right in the blueberry. And then if you squeezed it, you could see a little maggot pop out of the hole.
Is it just one that goes in or one egg that's laid?
Typically there's a few eggs in there. One female will lay 1 to 3 eggs in each time it, deposits one, but multiple females will lay eggs in the same fruit. So you'll see multiple holes and then the fruit's just not something you want to eat.
And is it something that is can be used for fruit, or juice, or any other something besides pig food? Or
yeah. I mean, a lot of the fruit, if it was only a small amount of infestation, it could go to juice. But some of the growers, you know, were seeing that there were so much infestation in the fruit that it was really not something you could use. So it could, you know, if this weren't managed properly, could turn into a pretty big threat.
Have there been any sightings, spottings, trappings in cities?
Yeah, actually, urban growers, it's a really high numbers in urban areas just because there's no one spraying insecticides typically in a backyard growing situation. So we did see quite a few. Actually, the first I found were in my mom's backyard in her cherries. So that was my...
And where was that?
In McMinnville. So, and we did find a lot in Yamhill County. So,
I have no trespassing signs up around my place. We'll
yeah, happen. That's what I'm hoping too. So, would it be a safe assumption to say that not all of these insecticides are considered organic?
Yeah, that would be a safe assumption to say. Yeah, there are some organic methods, and what I would recommend for the backyard grower, the easiest way to sort of control your numbers for next season is to fully get rid of all the fruit on the ground. So I know mm-hmm. it's a pain, but the best way is to pick all the rotting fruit off the ground, put it in a black plastic bag and leave it for a week, and that will kill the any eggs or maggots inside the fruit. So that's the best method. It's a pain for people with raspberries, blackberries, and such.
I would think if you had chickens, if you let your chickens run after the berries are harvested, let the chickens scratch around and get the fruit and any overwintering larvae and stuff that's down on the or going to overwinter.
Yeah, extra protein for the chickens.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and us too. We should point out that these aren't really harmful, are they, to humans?
Oh no, I ate so many maggots this summer, not knowing.
And she's just glowing here.
Yes, I'm very healthy after all that protein in the fruit. It's just it's an added bonus. So you don't taste them. I never knew it until I would check later and see that the fruit was full of maggots that I've been eating all day. So
the maggots are. Smaller than the adult.
Yes, the maggots are very small. Some of them are all hard to see, the size of a hair. Maybe they get a little bigger.
Heck, what's the problem here then?
Yeah,
you can't see them. You don't taste them.
That's yeah, right. No big deal. You know, it's just like high protein fruit.
Yeah,
really.
But then, for example, peaches will get soft and mushy.
Yeah,
if you wait too long to eat them.
Yeah.
No, I mean, if the incubation period
yes.
is further along.
Yes, yeah, it will rot the fruit much faster. So, as they get established in there, it would basically, you'll notice that a lot of the fruit is rotting before it's falling off the plant. So that's when you it's not as good to eat, I guess.
Jim, what was the fruit that you spotted these on the ground?
Honeyberry.
Honeyberry, huh?
It was the only place we trapped. The traps actually had, there was significant infestation. But we didn't. I ate the berries off the plants, and I never found a that I could tell. Of course, it was the size of knowing how small they are, maybe I was eating them. But
take your glasses off, eat away.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. But that was the only one.
Okay. Now, would you say that's a soft fruit?
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
okay.
It's sort of like a blueberry, you know.
So what would you say is safe? Apples, pears.
Yes.
What about plums?
Plums, they've been found to go in plums. I didn't find any in plums when I was trapping, but plums are later ripening. So, more in the fall. So we may have missed that those fruit. If the fruit is on the plant and it's not looking rotten, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Okay.
So, it's not going to hurt you, like I said.
Indeed.
And you've stopped trapping now, is that right?
We have, the company I was working for has one more scout who's out trapping, looking for any infestation in grapes, because it's really concerning to a lot of the vineyard owners around that these could potentially get into the grapes. So we're trying to monitor to see if anything goes there.
All right. That's it. The spotted wing Drosophila. The males have spots on their wings, and the females will have an ovipositor. But you're not going to be seeing that really without a microscope.
No, unless you knew what you were looking for.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And what's the color of these?
They are a brownish beige color, red eyes typically between 2 to 3 millimeters. They just look like a fruit fly. The males are the most distinguished, that you're going to see the spots on the wings.
Those wings stick up.
Yep.
And then there's two little spots. How about that? Pretty good name for that.
Well, I'm glad so far it hasn't been a real big problem for us. So, that's
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, part of that speculation of why it's not hasn't been such a problem is because of the wetter June and cooler June than normal. Would you?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, they prefer the temperatures and a little warmer. So around 70 degrees is when mm-hmm. they're most active. So, you know, we had a very cold June and I was outside in that. So I remember it was very cold and rainy. And that definitely, I think, helped the strawberry growers as there was never a problem in the strawberries. And then it sort of lowered the numbers for the raspberries, too, uh-huh. I think. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, the cold or wetter June made for pretty miserable beekeeping, too, but it turned out to be pretty not so bad. And that's kind of what we'll be covering in the next segment. But first, Jim and Emmy, thank you very much for coming today. Jim, you're going to take care of biz.
Yeah, and I'm going to go to Ohio next week for the annual Pawpaw Festival. Can you believe
that?
Well,
maybe next week we'll have some, next month we'll have some fruit tasting here too.
Yeah, I'll bring some in. We did that last year.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun.
Hey, matter of fact, next time is going to be pledge drive.
Oh, great. We'll get some plants too.
We'll get
then.
Some, that's right. We'll talk about
stay
that.
Stay tuned.
That's right. Emmy, thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
That was
everyone. Keep eating your fruit. Don't worry about it.
And so they're not into vegetables at all.
No, nothing in vegetables.
No tomatoes even or something like that.
Yeah, no, they don't like tomatoes. So don't worry about your tomatoes.
Okay. Well, it's 11:28, Jim. You know what time it is?
Is it garden stumper time?
It is garden stumper time.
Great.
Okay, here's today's garden stomper. Straight to the point. What is the Armenian blackberry? That's it. What is the Armenian blackberry? Okay, we'll open the phone lines to that, 231-8187. We'll take our second musical break and switch chairs here and get Taggart, John, and I don't know, is Jacqueline here? Jacqueline is here. We'll have a changing of the garden. We'll be back after Slim Harpo.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I can make honey, baby, let me come inside. I'm young and able to buzz all night long. I'm young and able to buzz all night long. Well, when you hear me buzzing, baby, some stinging is going on. Well, buzz a while. Sting it then. Well, I'm a king bee. Want you to be my queen. Well, I'm a king bee, want you to be my queen. Together we can make honey the world have never seen. King bee
can buzz all night long. Well, I can buzz better, baby, when your man is gone.
That's a recording from about 1958, Slim Harpo. I gave a beat talk some years ago and said, now let's listen to this song and now let's point out all the inaccuracies in this song here. I'm a king bee? Yeah. Okay, so here we are into round two. Taggart Siegel, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Yes.
All right, Glenn.
Taggart, the industrious film director. You must have something in the works too, eh?
Yes, we do. It's called Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us?
All right.
Yeah, it's a new documentary.
John Betts,
yeah.
Producer.
Yes.
Have you been working with Taggart before? Is that?
Actually, I came on just for starting for this film, and I've been working with him for 2 years now on Queen of the Sun, so it's been quite a process.
And how long have you been working on it, Taggart?
About 3 years.
3 years,
so okay. Granted, the real Dirt on Farmer John was 9 years. So this is 3 years. This is a lot faster.
Your next one, 3 weeks.
Yes.
And also in our studio now is Jacqueline Freeman.
Hi there.
Beekeeper, biodynamic beekeeper, and we'll talk about that from out of state.
Across the river.
That's right. And she is part of the film.
Uh-huh.
I have not seen the film, so I don't know how much you appear in there or what your role of that is. But Taggart, you can tell us, first of all, well, what's the nature of this? It's not, you don't really, from some of the literature, you don't really focus on the commercial beekeeper as much as individual beekeepers from around the world.
Right. My vision was to look at what Rudolf Steiner said about bees. If he said this in 1922, 23, he said if we continue the practice of over-queen breeding and the industrialized mechanical beekeeping, we'll see bees die out in 80 to 100 years. So back then it was kind of nonsense. No, that can't happen, mm-hmm. according to one of the beekeepers at that time, because they saw that queen breeding was such an exciting new thing. But, you know, here we are 80 to 100 years later, and we're seeing massive declines. So that sort of started me into that journey around the world, speaking to biodynamic and organic beekeepers around the world, but also contrasting it with commercial beekeepers.
Why don't we get some definitions here of biodynamic beekeeping, organic beekeeping? Jacqueline?
Well, we have a farm, Friendly Haven Rise Farm, up in Ventersburg, which is just east of Battleground. And we use biodynamic principles, so we follow a lot of the guidelines that Rudolf Steiner set down ages ago, beginning of the last century. And I think probably the most significant thing about it is that inherent in everything that we do on the farm, there's a caring and a respect and a kindness to everything on the farm, whether it's the fruit trees or the bumblebees or the cows. Everything is valued as an individual. And that's the thing that I like the most. And I think that's the thing that, as a biodynamic beekeeper and farmer, has helped me grow the most as well.
Well, how does that differ from just natural beekeeping, we might say, or... I'm trying to get at what makes it biodynamic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand your compassion, mm-hmm. but the biodynamic principles put forth, were they applied to beekeeping by Rudolf Steiner?
That's a really good question. One of the things that that I've been learning as I've been doing these practices is that rather than try and save the weaker bees, we strengthen the bees and help the bees grow stronger. And that's how we do that. And that's actually a hard part for me because I came from being organic first. There are a lot of organic principles that you use in caring for bees. We don't use chemicals, and we can use organic methods to help bees out. Instead of that, though, we focus on creating strength within the hive, and that way really fostering a lot of the building up the hive so that the hive is strong enough to handle any of the things that get thrown at it, like mites or just any kind of a weakness. The breeding, we obviously go straight through with swarming and letting them breed naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And finding that the stronger the bees are, the less problems we have.
Sure.
Yeah, not replacing the queen every year, which a lot of commercial beekeepers might replace them every year, maybe twice a year if they really feel like they need to.
Mm-hmm.
But queen bees live up to 3 to 6 years if their vitality is there. But bees, you know, the queens are getting weaker and weaker and weaker, so that's not a good sign.
Yes, indeed. The genetic stock here in the United States is pathetic.
Yeah.
It's one way to put it.
Yeah. And there's something that people do. They often stop the swarming activity of bees because most bees.
How do they do that?
Well, the hive lays the queens.
How do they try to do that?
Yes. The hive lays queens when they feel like they're ready to go. Swarming is the natural way that bees propagate a new hive. So we want to be doing that, especially when bees are on the decrease. You know, we're losing 35% of our bees every year.
Yeah, nationwide.
Wow.
I lose about 2/3 of mine, so.
Yeah, so what we
that
do
sounds
is
sounds good to me.
In normal beekeeping, conventional beekeeping, you break the queen eggs off. You cut them off so that they won't swarm, because they won't swarm unless there are new queens coming up. We let them swarm and let them do all their breeding on their own. When a new queen in a new hive goes out to mate, when she's born naturally and she's in that hive and she goes out to mate, she mates with the strongest of the male drones. I love this story. When drones are the boys. They're responsible for mating with new queens.
The king bees.
Yes. And the drones go out every day, middle of the day, like between 11, 12, 1-ish, and they all hang out about 300 feet up somewhere. And all the drones from all the hives go to the same place. And they all just kind of swarm around. I think of it kind of like the bee dating bar. And all they're waiting for is a virgin queen to come through. And when that new queen is born and she goes out to mate, she knows, she can tell where that drone dating bar is. And she goes flying up through them. She shoots through like a rocket. So when the drones go after her to chase, only the strongest drones can reach and mate with her. So right there, you have something that's quite a bit different than the artificial queen breeding program. You have the fastest, strongest drones getting to mate with the new queen, and that's the birth of a new hive.
And in Queen of the Sun, what are the bees telling us? In the film, we couldn't film that up 600 feet up with the mating, because she mates with up to 15 male drones. And so we got it animated, and it's beautiful animation. It's very in the style of the Waldorfian paintings, which is just kind of very dreamy watercolor with these bees, the queen bee shooting up 600 feet being mated. So it's we include animation a lot into the film.
John, this... are you responsible for what are you responsible for? What does a producer do?
Sure, that's a really good question, especially when it comes to independent documentary. And a lot of times I think of it this way. Taggart has the vision of the film, and when I came on to help him with the film, it became this co-collaboration of we edited the film together and we worked together to contact beekeepers and to line things up. And so a lot of what I've done is the dirty work, and Taggart does the dirty work too, and we share that. And then I've also been the sounding board for ideas and, okay, what's kind of working, what's not working, and let's get a second opinion on this. And then really making things happen. So, for instance, for all of that animation, it's contacting, finding animators that are going to be a good fit for this and matching them up to these styles. And we have a number of different styles in the film, which is, I think, one of the really incredible things in the film is all of these different styles coming together, and really we really built a community of people to make the film around it. So a lot of what I feel like I do is help hold that community together and bring people together around it.
Is there somebody else on board that does the distribution and that kind of stuff, or is it you guys?
Well, Collective Eye, which is a nonprofit started in 2002, is a nonprofit I started because I saw that there was, it was very difficult getting films out in the world through normal distribution sort of venues. So we established this so we could start becoming stronger to distribute our own films. And that's what The Real Dirt on Farmer John was, the greatest training ground, because the only way that film succeeded was through community, through grassroots marketing around the world and around the country. And I saw this, but I didn't see the distributor doing that. I saw them putting big ads in newspapers and trying to get great reviews and things like that, which all help, but they weren't going to the people as much. So that's exactly what we're doing with Queen of the Sun, is really bringing it out to communities. And we have around 20 sponsors for Queen of the Sun. And it's really great because they all have their memberships and their emails, and they help get the word out about the film. So we're really excited about opening on September 17th and having a run as long as it possibly can with all the sponsors and all the people coming together, from farmers markets to New Seasons, to the Audubon Society, to Xerces Society, all these great organizations that are really coming together.
All right, let's take our last musical break here, and we'll come back and talk about Jacqueline's part in the movie and how many other beekeepers you talk to. Should be good.
Great.
Thank you.
clarinet of Richard Stoltzman. That's called Sky. How about that?
It's fitting.
Very nice.
Nice.
So, swarm rescuing.
Yes, I love rescuing swarms. You know, we have people, there are so many people who've seen swarms and they think they're dangerous. They think that they're something to be feared. And, it really breaks my heart when I see people out there trying to hurt the bees. I had somebody call me just a few weeks ago and, you know, said that their mother had been out with a hose spraying down a big old swarm all day trying to break it up. And I thought, oh, that just kills the bees.
That's just ignorance, yeah.
Yes, and one time I was driving home and a few miles from my house, I saw a kid about 12 years old standing in a field with a swarm at the end of the field and a can of Raid spraying them. And I thought, you know, they just don't know. And I think that's probably, if I could do one thing on the radio today, that's what I would like to do, have people realize that swarms are how bees propagate, how they become a new hive. They're completely harmless when they're swarming. And people always think they're going to be attacked by a big cloud of bees. When you see a big cloud of bees, or especially if you've seen them where they've roosted waiting, all they're doing is looking for a new home. Their bellies are filled with honey. They fill up with honey before they leave the hive. And they, as one elderly beekeeper told me once, they couldn't sting if they wanted to. Their fat little bellies are so full. But they have no intention of stinging anyway. They have nothing to protect. They're homeless at that point. And without something to protect, they really don't care. So what I'd recommend people do is if you see a swarm, just give it wide berth. It usually takes them 1, 2, possibly even 3 days while they have the scouts going out looking for a new home. And during that time, they just sit peacefully and wait. And then when the scouts find them a new home, then they all up and move. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful thing. If you see one, it's an act of you know, a force of nature. It's just beautiful to see them all together like that.
And in the film, you filmed her going to gather a swarm?
Yes, in a suburb of Portland, we go out to this neighborhood, and the woman was very scared that there was a swarm on her back fence. And it was this beautiful little clump of bees. But Jacqueline goes out there with one of her students that suddenly is there, she's going to get her first beehive. So it's very exciting to show her transfer these bees into this woman's bee box to take home. So, you know, she became a beekeeper within the film. But the extraordinary thing is that we were in the Bronx on the rooftop, and it was illegal beekeepers, and we were filming.
Because at that time, haven't they?
New York City is now legal. It was not legal during the Giuliani period. And so now it's legal, but it was illegal just like 6 months ago or a year ago. And we were filming, and she was just showing me this beautiful little beehive that she had. And then suddenly she looks up, and there's like thousands of bees heading our way. And it's a swarm. And it's in the Bronx, and it lands literally right like 10 feet away on a tree. And it was like, I have not seen a swarm in 3 years trying to find a swarm, and it ends up being in the Bronx where we find a swarm. But there are magical moments throughout the whole film. I mean, the beekeepers around the world, they're extraordinary people. And, you know, from Yvonne Huchard, who's a poet and a...
He's a bee historian.
Bee historian, and he likes to tickle his bees with his mustache. And he, you know, there's this incredible respect and love for a lot of these beekeepers, and they have incredible personality. But we also have the very, very much the dark side. We're looking at, you know, Michael Pollan going into monoculture and the almond fields and the 600,000 acres of monoculture where bees, there's no food for them except for the 2 weeks while the almond blossoms are on, but they're being trucked around the whole country. So we see a real decline and devastation through the pesticides and through this system of farming.
Feeding them high fructose corn syrup rather than letting them live off their honey, you know, and all these different things that the industrial agricultural system has sort of, in a way, created. And so now the bees, in order to pollinate these massive crops, they have to be trucked in. They have to somehow there has to be pollination on these crops where bees can't live unless, you know, for the, unless they're in there for the 2 weeks of the bloom, the rest of the year, they couldn't live there. So it's, you know, there's so many different aspects to the bee crisis that we go into in the film.
Do you, is it strictly honeybees that you're, that you deal with here?
Yes, except for there's one section with Scott Black from the Xerces Society who talks about other pollinators. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's 4,000 other bees in the world, and a lot of
That's just in the United States. There's about 20,000 species of bees in the world. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, in the United States, and many of those are in decline. So we have to, any bee out there, whether it's a wasp or a bee, we really have to be grateful for, especially those, you know, those little mason bees that fly in our backyard. So even though the honeybee is our main focus, we do care about all the sentient beings out there. And Vandana Shiva really goes into that, too.
John, do you have bees?
I don't have bees. I wish
Get out of here.
I wish I did. The one of the most exciting things, actually, in the past month or two, besides, obviously, setting up the Portland theatrical premiere on the 17th, is that Taggart himself got a beehive in his backyard. And that's
They're fascinating to watch.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, there's been a lot of things in the last month. Tell us about the proclamation here. We got the...
So we've been busy, and so many people have been helping out in Portland. It's really been just a wonderful show of support in Portland. And actually, on September 15th, there's going to be a proclamation read by, I believe, by Sam Adams at the City Hall, a city council meeting.
Himself a beekeeper.
Yeah, who himself is a beekeeper, appropriate enough. And he will be reading this proclamation, where we have actually in front of us here a few lines. So I don't know, Jacqueline, do you want to read a few lines?
Whereas the honeybee is responsible for over 40% of all the pollination of all the food we eat, and whereas the honey produced by honeybees is delicious, healthful, and therapeutic, and whereas the honeycomb wax created by honeybees is a miracle of engineering, and the light it creates is a comfort and joy to people, and whereas the honeybee's domestication thousands of years ago resulted in dependence upon human care, and, here it shifts, whereas Portland is a leader among the cities involved in sustainable farming and beekeeping practices that will be necessary to reverse colony collapse disorder, and whereas the new documentary, Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us?, a project of the nonprofit Collective Eye, is created by Portland citizens and features our residents with other beekeeper scientists, artists, and philosophers from around the world who are working to bring these problems to light. And whereas Queen of the Sun is partnering for its theatrical release in Portland with many diverse local organizations, and then it lists all of the organizations, whereas each Portland resident can be part of supporting the health of the honeybee by avoiding the use of toxic pesticides on their lawns and gardens, by buying food from farmers who avoid toxic pesticides, by planting flowers for honeybee forage, by calling for a swarm rescue expert rather than an exterminator if a bee swarm arrives near their house, and by reducing the misplaced fear of honeybees with an understanding that honeybees are very rarely the source of most insect stings. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim September 17th through September 23rd, 2010, to be Honeybee Week.
Right.
Yeah, it's just absolutely awesome. And also, there's going to be a tour to Hive, too, and that's going to be on September 25th. From 1 to 4 p.m. It's a self-guided tour with stops primarily in the Northeast, Southeast, and North Portland. And you could register is required.
You can actually sign up if you send an email to touredtohives@gmail.com. You can contact Lauren and sign up for that. And it'll be a walking and biking tour all around the backyard beehives in Portland.
And come to queenofthesun.com to check and see. There's a bee costume night on the 18th at 9:30, and there'll be prizes. So come as a queen bee or drone or a worker, and come and celebrate the film with us.
So that's the world debut?
Is the 17th.
September 17th. 7:30 showing is the world theatrical debut of Queen of the Sun.
At the Hollywood Theater.
At the Hollywood Theater. We'll be very excited to see everyone there.
And then it will be playing after that.
For 2 to 3 weeks or longer. And there'll be some prizes donated by some of the sponsors. So your raffle ticket, you buy a ticket, you will possibly be a winner of one of the prizes.
Taggart, are you on the tour to Hives?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And
yeah.
As am I. So.
Oh, great.
Maybe we'll see you there.
Yes. And thank you.
Great. And we're teaching, I teach B classes at our farm up in east of Battleground. And if you'd like to register for a class that we teach on this kind of biodynamic beekeeping, you can go to friendlyhaven.com and click on the link there for the classes.
That's Jacqueline Freeman.
Mm-hmm. We do one every month.
Thank you very much for coming. John Betts.
Thank you.
Producer, Queen of the Sun. You producing other things too now?
No. We are very much focused on Queen of the Sun.
And Taggart Siegel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Glenn.
For coming in and sharing your enthusiasm as well as knowledge and efforts.
Thank you.
This is Glenn Andreessen. Jim and I will be back next week. It's the Pledge Drive. Jim will be bringing in some fantastical edible plants for pledge premiums there. Thank you, gifts. Thanks for listening. Be well.